This episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour, is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based, lottery, and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. For more information, visit GamingLabs.com. Hello and welcome to another episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour. I am not the eponymous host. I am the frequently introduced assistant or sidekick, comic relief, you might say, to my extremely austere, stern, stentorian co-host, colleague, Dr. Michael Hour. Dr. Hour, hello.
Hey, how are you doing? I have no idea what you just said. But
it's for the best.
It was just pleasantries, right?
It was all complimentary.
Absolutely.
All of it.
You wouldn't dare say anything else.
I wouldn't. Yeah. You know, it's not for nothing that you're known as, what is it? What's your nickname again? Ah, the Kaiser. That's it. Yeah. Good times. So, Dr. Hour, it's nice to be here again, recording another hour with you. But luckily, it's not just you today. We have some guests.
Pretty ones.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Now I'm going to have to edit this, aren't I?
I don't.
You know what kind of relief it is for me to have you on the left side and him at the top right? No?
So you can just... But, so... Team. Of course, we only put out...
I'm going to make you much smaller now on my screen, you know.
Like, we only put out an audio podcast, so nobody is aware of what our guests look like. And of course, everybody knows that a person's value is not based on their physical appearance, which is lucky for you, Dr. Hour.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what would happen otherwise, right? I mean,
that's right. We'd be mobbed.
Absolutely.
By angry crowds with pitchforks and burning torches, screaming, slay the monster, storming the castle. Anyway, I digress. So we're joined, so returning guests, not returning to this podcast. We've had these guys on the OG podcast, The Gambling Files. We've had one of them on that twice. So either gluttons for punishment, I don't know, maybe they just have low self-esteem. It's hard to say for sure. But we are joined by Claire Jones and Lorraine Perrins of Gambling Recovery for All. Claire, hello.
Hello, John. What a great welcome.
Thanks. And Lorraine, hello.
Hello, John and Michael. Thank you for such a warm welcome.
That's okay. We're very happy to have you here. So Lorraine, right, ages ago, like you came on the original podcast, on the Gambling Files podcast, because I'd seen something that you put on LinkedIn and I was like, oh, this woman's got to be talking out of her ass. And it was about, sorting out gambling addiction in something like six sessions or something like that. It was something that just sounded absolutely bonkers. Of course, it was more nuanced than that. What you'd done there was use the old headline trick very effectively. But what you said to me in that was, I will give you a session of, treatment because I'm horrifically needle phobic. And you sent me a recording to work with after that. And I did that for like a month or whatever it is. And I still use it. I use it every time I have to give a blood sample, every time I have to have any kind of an injection or anything like that. I've got your little voice in my ear
saying, every night.
You're not shit. You're not. But no, it's incredibly effective. I don't know whether I told you this, right, but the moment that I knew that it had an impact was I was walking to the doctor's, and there was a line in the recording that you did, and it was something like, you know, you're a perfectly capable adult or something like that, you know, but there was a line in it which said, you have a smile on your face. And I was walking to this, you know, doom laden appointment of blood being taken with this big grin on my face. And I'm like, what the hell? Why am I smiling? And that was the moment where I thought, oh shit, maybe it works.
There you go.
That was the day I became a true believer.
And can you tell people how bad it was prior to that? Because that was what I found fascinating.
Several phlebotomists told me I'm the worst they've ever seen. But I'm a little bit different to other people in that, because obviously people when they're afraid have fairly standard sort of reactions. You know, there's heightened emotion. There is violence. There's some people faint. Like, I've never fainted. I've never gone off at anybody, but I have made it very clear that they're not coming near me with that fucking thing in their hand. And it takes, you know, just to take a blood sample can take half an hour at least.
What you doing, like, in that situation? You fight it, you run away?
No, I'll sit there and I'll chat about everything that comes to mind. I had a nice chat with a phlebotomist once about the work of Ray Harryhausen.
What's a phlebotomist?
Somebody that professionally takes blood.
Really? There's a name for it?
Yeah, my sister's a phlebotomist, weirdly enough.
Are you making this up or is this... Weirder. Are you making this
true.
Up or is this real?
True story.
Phlebotomist. Okay.
Phlebotomist. P-H-L-E. Phlebotomist.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I understand.
Mm-hmm. It'll be from the Greek, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, phlegmatic, right? Comes probably originate from the Greek.
I don't know. You're the doctor.
Yeah, I just told you, man.
Well, yeah, but you're looking for corroboration. Lorraine, Claire, have you got a doctorate?
No.
And the onus is on you, Dr. Auer.
I'm medically trained, I mean, partially in the military. I was a, what you call it, you know?
Chef.
So I could. a butcher. Next time we're going to talk about this, John, when you visit me in Austria.
Yeah, I think you've got some issues that you need to get out there.
So you're in a much better place now, John, aren't you? That's really good to hear.
Yeah, and I mean, it's progressing. You know, it takes a little bit less time each time. I still use, you know, you can get that Emla cream that makes your skin numb. But that's the daft thing about it. And like, whenever you tell people that you have a fear, they will try and rationalize it.
Of course.
Even if it is genuinely a phobia, they will try and rationalize that. And like, so I had this big splinter the one day, right? Big piece of wood went in my hand and my hand came up like four times the size. And I went to the doctor. I'm like, my hand's a bit swollen. It's got a bit of wood in it. And he's like, you need to go to the fracture clinic. So I go to the fracture clinic and the bloke, he's like, I can cut your hand open and have a look for it. And I said, okay, go on then. And he's like, so I'm just going to inject it with some. I said, no, you're not. I said, you can cut it open. You can root around. Like, I'm okay with pain. You can just go for it. But you're not injecting me. Like, I know logically that the injection is going to hurt much less than the piece of wood that went in there. I know that it's going to hurt much less than somebody just rooting around in my hand. But the phobia part of it is the part that defines it as irrational. And people just don't get that. They will always try, yeah, but it's this. Yeah, but you can do that. Yeah, but you can shut up and piss off. Because it's a phobia and I'll kill you all. Anyway, I got sidetracked.
Claire, are you both psychologists?
No, neither of us are psychologists. Okay.
These guys are at the coal face, Dr.
Yeah, no, I thought you might be, you know, behavior therapists.
Yeah, no, we're clinical hypnotherapists.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hypnotherapist, cool.
Hypnotherapists, it was
Lorraine's hypnotherapy that I was talking about using.
So what, Lorraine, you understand? So you produced a recording for John.
No, we did a session.
A session, okay.
Yeah, and then I produced a recording because obviously the mind learns by repetition. Mm-hmm. Hence why John is always smiling these days.
So this is auto suggestion, probably, right? So he listens to it, okay.
So what we do with our hypnotherapy, it's we get to the root cause of why of the behavior. Mm-hmm. So we're not just traditional hypnotherapists that we say you're not going to do X, Y, and Z. We go deep into what's driving it.
And in your gambling recovery therapy, that's what the two of you, you know, are running. You apply the same approach to cure addiction, gambling addiction.
Is that the heart of what you do, or is it a facet?
So we don't say that we cure. So Claire and I, so initially it was working with gambling addiction, and then Claire and I have joined together and realised this is such a big space for affected others, so we do both.
So how does that typically work? So the two of you have a practice, I assume, and affected others and addicts seek your help.
Yes.
They come in. How does a typical session work? Or do you have any exclusion, inclusion criteria for clients? Like what's the profiling process look for? So let's say somebody walks in the door, what's the first thing you ask them to make sure you can help them, or they might, you know, have to look up another professional?
So we both work remotely, so we work worldwide. Mm-hmm. Remote, since COVID, the sort of model changed to remote, and people have reported it works just as successful, if not more successful, for all modalities, because people are relaxed in their own environment. So often people are lying on their bed. Mm-hmm. We do have, so we'll only, you probably want to go into this more, Claire. We do have certain criteria. They won't just walk in and we see them. They will complete, initially we have a 30-minute session with them, complimentary. And we go through all their issues, and then if they decide to go ahead, then they will complete a comprehensive intake form. Mm-hmm. So there are certain exclusions, aren't there, Claire?
Yeah. So sort of anybody that's like actively psychotic, or has sort of epilepsy, we would always ask, or any kind of medical condition that's not sort of currently stable, we'd always ask them to kind of link in with a GP. And it might be that that hypnotherapy on those accounts isn't the most suitable thing for us to try. So, you know, it really is like a multi-professional approach. But in terms of somebody, you know, having an effective result, they obviously need to be committed to the process. They need to be committed to doing things in a different way that they've done before. They need to they basically need to know that they deserve a future, or want a future that's different from the current future that they're living in. So in terms of their commitment to stopping a behavior, that's you know, essential. We don't have sort of the ability to work with people that kind of aren't, obviously everybody has concerns about stopping a behavior, it's not that, but if there was somebody that was very kind of fixed mindset that really when you're on a call with them, you can assess that actually they're not quite ready for change or are going to take their part in being responsible for change, then it wouldn't be the right time necessarily for them to work with us. So
I can give a really good example of that. There was contacted by a guy, well, I was contacted initially by his wife and I said, it's got to come from the husband. And then I arranged a 30-minute session with them, introductory session, and the wife turned up on the call. So then she went and fetched her husband, and ultimately that sort of session would not work because they're not committed to the change.
Yeah, I've booked therapy for others before, and it is the old, you can lead a horse to water but you can't cure its broken brain.
No,
I think that's the expression.
Which is the most, you know, frustrating thing in some respects for affected others, because it's often that long before the gambler, in this case, in their life is possibly ready for treatment, they would already be seeing the signs and the disruption that would make an affected other want to seek support. And it's this fine dance and balance, isn't it? Because obviously, until you're aware of the impact and that things need to change, you know, you can't be blamed for things that you're not aware of. So it's this kind of education, awareness, perspective piece that's so essential, but also the affected other realizing actually what's within their control and what's theirs to sort and what's the gamblers to follow through on and sort. So, you know, we'd never say to affected other, you know, don't leave literature around or don't direct someone to our website, but then at some point they then, you know, the in our case, you know, we mainly work with gamblers, but for then the gambler, that's the person struggling with gambling, would then have to, you know, take it forward.
How often, if I may ask, sorry, John, to interrupt, does, in your experience, an affected other manage to convince, you know, or to sort of, you know, to move along the addict in the process of change?
So we run a Gamily Facebook group for affected others of gambling. We've got 2,300 members worldwide. Mm-hmm. And that is the most frustrating thing, isn't it, Claire?
Mm. Yeah, I think it'd be really hard to give you an exact sort of percentage.
But it's rare, basically. That's what you're saying.
It's got to come from them.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and that's like, you know, the stages of change model. I'm sure you are aware of it, right? I mean, that's as old, I mean, whatever, from the 1960s was published, or was originated from smoking cessation research. And it might sound very easy or obvious, but if the person doesn't want to change, it won't happen, right? It's not magic in any way.
Exactly that. Yeah.
And in your experience, the ones who seek therapy or also seek help, are there any commonalities among them? Like what happened to them in gambling? Did they lose all their money? I mean, what did it affect their social situation, work situation?
I think the biggest reason or somebody reached out to change is when they realize the behavior is no longer in line with their values. So like somebody doesn't actually have to lose everything in order to seek help. We've just had people, really, it's somebody that's realised that this behaviour is really not in line with their values. It's causing a lot of shame and guilt and, you know, they're just hugely kind of disappointed and, you know, frustrated, angry, disappointed, sad. I mean, really strong, heavy emotions. But I'd say that's, you know, we have people that come in that haven't maybe necessarily confided in their family. We've got other people that have confided. You know, there doesn't seem to be you know, we've had people that have lost huge amount, you know, hundreds and thousands of money. And we've had people that, you know, would be still with under the sort of 10,000 kind of mark, you know, which obviously is still a lot of money. But it doesn't, there doesn't seem to be anything, any other patterns necessarily, but really it's values that stands out the most.
I think it's interesting what you're saying, because there is this extreme emphasis, you know, on money lost, especially like in the regulatory world, and we discussed this a lot of times before, that it's not just about money.
No,
gambling,
no.
Right? I mean, it's about an escapism. It, of course, adds something to their life. They do it for a reason other than money, because everybody who is somehow sane in their mind understands at some point of time that you won't win.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Claire and I went to a rehab place and to visit, and we sat and spoke to the residents. And one thing that I've always remembered, they said it's not about the money. Mm. They're escaping emotional pain.
Mm. And in your experience, what are the things that sort of are at the bottom of a gambling problem? Because like we said, you know, it's a symptom of something else.
Yes.
Could be, yeah, you know, depression or social issues or whatever. But in your
is there something you're seeing that's more common?
So it is very individual for people, but there is always a pain. So it's a meaning or a belief that they've attached to a certain situation that's happened. It doesn't always have to be childhood, but there is a lot of stuff. And it doesn't have to be what we call the big T traumas. It can be the small T traumas. It's basically somewhere along the line, somebody's attached a meaning or belief to an event that causes them pain, emotional pain. And so the behavior is really run very subconsciously. And it's emotion over logic. And that's again why we were talking earlier. I can't remember if it was in this recording or off of it, but saying how, you know, like emotion will always win over logic. And so they can be moving away from pain or moving towards pleasure. So there'll be something that we can help somebody reframe. And it's brilliant doing it under hypnosis, because it kind of bypasses the critical part of the brain that would kind of use the logic to rationalize things. But you can get to the places where there's emotion attached to events. And equally, we find that it's not just the hypnosis we use. We use a lot of embodiment and somatic techniques, because it's about emotional regulation as well. So often people will use a behavior to regulate their nervous system. So you might find kind of like through a stressful working, a stressful event, or as we've said, other emotions like anger or guilt or shame or what have you. But they haven't learnt how to regulate their emotions in healthier ways. So there's a big part as well where we can support, where we do support with that side of things.
Got to go back a little bit here. I know you saw, I just, when you're like, and I speak as somebody has multiple addictions, none of the really bad ones though.
Yeah.
just some fun shit. But there's a period when you quit something where you are kind of full of piss and vinegar and you're like quite zealous about you're quite passionate, you're feeling, oh, I feel so much better. I'm wondering, well, you were talking about confirming commitment before.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the Lorraine's example was a really, you know, an obvious example that the person that needs the help isn't the driver of seeking help, and that's not going to work ever. But how do you actually? I mean, I know you say they get a. I think I can't remember what the term was that you used, Claire, but it was like a detailed questionnaire to kick things off, right?
Intake form.
Mm. I mean, is there a box on that which is like, are you committed? Mm. And if they haven't ticked it, you're like, they can get, they're not for us. How are you sure about commitment? Because that there's, like I said, that period of zeal.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we
it,
do.
It does. It's like the old adage, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Yeah. Yeah. So we know completely that. And obviously we change, don't we? As in what we decide today can be different tomorrow or in a month's time. And so, yeah, we have got crystal balls, etc. But you get a feeling from someone. We do ask them to rate it, and it's part of our conversation with them. They need to confirm with us verbally, as well as having written it on their form, exactly around, you know, what we the thing we talk about, commitment, and what it's going to take from them. And we also, by getting them to tap into their values as well, and looking at, well, what behavior, what kind of need is this behavior meeting? Because you can start to give somebody a lot of education and awareness, and remove a lot of the guilt and shame, even in the first 30-minute call anyway, by explaining exactly some of the topics we've covered today. You know, it's not logical. You know, it is a really, really clever coping mechanism that was serving you until it's not. And, you know, right from the beginning, you know, we really support somebody to commit to the process. But obviously, you know, as you go through anything, you know, people can change. But, you know, if you get a good feeling from someone, you know, it's like in anything you do, like if you were interviewing for a job or whatever, you'd get a really good sense, wouldn't you? If somebody's saying the right thing, showing the right things, got the right nonverbal communication, etc. You might be wrong further down the line, but you've done your best to support them to be committed and find out if they are committed.
And it is a commitment when they choose to work with us, because there is a very comprehensive form. There's an emotions matrix, there's core values, there's a therapy agreement. And just by doing that, they've already shown that level of commitment.
Yeah.
And
okay.
Are they, I mean, often the reasons for their behavior, gambling, whatever it is, are subconscious, right? So in my experience, so I've talked to a number of, you know, lived experience, and often they couldn't even tell, you know, why they did it.
Right.
They did it for whatever. And in your sessions, I mean, does the hypnotherapy help to shed more insight into subconsciously?
Yeah.
So would they say then after a couple sessions, oh my God, you know, I never thought that this was actually the reason why I did it?
Always.
Yeah. It's light bulb moments.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like an epiphany moment.
Yeah.
And some of it's, some of the trauma has been so buried so deeply, they just completely weren't aware of it.
Mm. And it's also not to say as well that, you know, depending on the level of trauma, you know, people have got obviously very, very different pasts. Some people also want to talk more about what's gone on, and some people don't. So we've got different methods of hypnotherapy, and we do coaching sessions in between, and we've got different methods that we can work with someone. So we sort of, it's very fluid. So we're waiting to see kind of what they're feeding back, what information we're getting, where they're at, how they're getting on with the different tools and techniques that we're providing. And then we can adapt things as we move through the process with them.
Slight sideways step, maybe a little, but I'm curious about your journey to get here, right? Why? And I'm not. This isn't a question about efficacy. This is just a question about your choices, right? So why did you? Hang on. I'm not sure where to start with the question, so bear with me. This might go
all start over. At the beginning, John.
I'm not sure there is a beginning. Like perfectly circular. But did you two meet and then go, hey, let's do some hypnotherapy stuff? Was there a reason why you arrived at hypnotherapy as the tool that you wanted to use? Was it the purpose first and then you found the tool? Or how did you arrive at doing this with this tool now?
So to start with, Claire lives in West Sussex and I live in Nottingham. So there was definitely no bumping into each other because we're about 4.5 hours away. So we both, during COVID, we both had lots of NHS experience. Claire said earlier, she's been an occupational therapist previously for how many years, Claire?
I think 16 years.
And I've been in senior management transformational roles working in the NHS for about 17 years. And then during COVID, we both had never met. We went to train with Marissa Peer. It was all online. And then when it opened up to being in person, that's where Claire and I met.
And the reason why we picked, or why I picked to go with Marissa Peer was because I think as you're about to train or learn anything, we've done a lot of our own healing ourselves, obviously through certain events and experiences that we've had in our own lives. But when you actually work with hypnosis and find out, you know, the power of accessing the subconscious, and then you obviously do a lot of research as well into the different types of modalities that are around, it felt like a no-brainer for me to pick hypnosis. Obviously, it's lots of people love different things and it's different courses for different horses. It's definitely not one size fits all, but that was my main driver for you know, studying with Marissa Peer, rapid transformational therapy. And since then as well, we've gone on to learn lots of other modalities as well. So we do actually use, as I said earlier, like a real combination, but that's being able to access the subconscious using hypnotherapy is really effective.
So then we always stayed in touch, and I went on, we were told to niche, and obviously I was married to somebody I was previously married with somebody with a gambling addiction. So I thought, I wonder if this can work with people with gambling addiction. And then Claire and I were having a conversation one day, and as we were talking, I said, oh, it sounds like you want to work with affected others, and there the story began, really, of working together.
Okay. Now, this also possibly slightly peculiar question. So I used to work with this bloke, right? And he claimed to me that some of his friends knew he was a bit artistic, so they said to him, would you do a tattoo for me? Despite the fact he'd never done a tattoo before, right? Now, that is absolute horseshit, or his friends are all idiots. However, he is now a tattooist. He's also, by all accounts, still an absolute penis. But that is by the by. But the reason I'm asking this is, like, when you trained, there must have been a time when you were like, okay, what we've learned is going to help people. We're good with that. But when you started seeing clients, that it must, with your first clients, it must have been kind of nerve-wracking. I mean, there must have been nerves involved. Did you practice on friends and family members before you unleashed yourself on the public?
So we have to practice with each other during training. And I personally didn't practice with, I practiced with friends. I didn't practice with family. Advised not to, really. And because of what may show up.
Yeah, then you might find out what you've done to them.
But John, that's part of psychotherapy education, right? You probably still undergo supervision, right? You have your supervisors there who help you with difficult cases, correct?
But going to the question of did we practice on friends and family, I did with friends, but not with family.
You've got to be as careful as well about ego parts as well, because, you know, there's obviously lots of different theories, but, you know, somebody's got to feel, like Lorraine said, you know, they've got to feel safe and willing to open, be vulnerable, disclose, you know, and it's just not appropriate necessarily with certain people. So, or they're even at conscious level, they might not even acknowledge that, but they'll have an ego part inside that's kind of screaming at them like, no, you're not going to go there, you're not going to go there. I think our bodies are really like intuitive, and you'll only be presented with information that you're ready to kind of listen to and heal and face. And I think there's lots of people that's carrying around a lot of pain, that, you know, it feels scary to go back and face, you know, lots of people, hence why they use behaviors that help them avoid the pain, you know, so it can feel scary to go back and face things. But I always like kind of say, like, you're carrying it around anyway with you, you know, whether you're aware of it or not, and it's coming out in your behaviors. So, you know, you can go back with a curious kind of exploratory mindset and start looking at things. But I think, you know, you want to work with people that feel, you know, like they're able to be fully open and comfortable with you. And, you know, that's not the case with some people, is it, that are either friends or family. But yeah, there's lots of practice, lots and lots of practice as part of the course.
And pets.
What?
Well, it's funny you should say that, John. There's a really funny story here. Sorry to interrupt, Michael. Claire, I went to stay at it's Claire's mother-in-law's last week, and we were recording every day for the program, and the dog, Logan. Claire did a hypnosis on me, and Logan shot up and banged his head on the table, didn't he?
After the hypnosis had finished and I brought both Lorraine and Logan round, then Logan sort of like and walked in. But we obviously were not 100% sure, but it did seem like potentially we'd hypnotized him. But no, we don't normally. Logan,
did he snap out of it, or does he think he's a cat now?
He hasn't meowed yet.
But I mean,
it's a real danger.
When I, you know, imagine hypnosis, I'm thinking of Tim Robbins, you know, the
Tony
Robbins, the guru, right? The public speaker, you know, yeah. The guy, right? But it's nothing like that, is it?
No, I don't even know that Tony Robbins does hypnosis, does he?
He's in this movie, Shallow Hell. Have you seen this movie with Jack Black?
Oh, Shallow Hell.
And I don't know who's the female star.
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Okay.
Oh, talking of Logan, he's arrived.
Yay.
Sure.
But no, it's not stage hypnosis. You know, you're complete. Yeah. Sorry.
He's big. I mean, you should be careful hypnotizing him, you know.
He might
come up with ideas.
But yeah, it's not stage hypnosis. You're in complete control the whole time. You know, you can choose to take on the command. You can choose not to. You can come out of it. You know, we create a safe place. You know, you can count your way out. So it's definitely, if anyone's listening to this and thinking it's like, the things they see on stage where you turn into a chicken or a fire hydrant and things like that. That's not part of it.
But there is this, I don't know what it's called, like the stage hypnotists, they first look for people who are more suggestible.
Yeah.
Did you ever encounter a client who would sort of, different levels of, susceptibility?
Yes.
Some are easier, some are harder to sort of get into the state.
Yeah, so basically it's about following the commands. If somebody turns up and doesn't follow along, it's not going to work. But that's, again, part of their commitment to it.
I mean, assume if somebody's mind is racing, right? If they basically are easily diverted, it's probably harder compared to somebody who, let's say, meditates, you know, and sort of can... Let's go. Yes,
exactly. And we do, so the precursor to any deep dive hypnotherapy session, in fact, we spend an hour and a half on it prior to doing the deeper dive hypnotherapy, is embodiment and somatic tools. So we're already looking to get somebody's nervous system regulated so they're not in an alert state. If somebody's sort of, you know, their internal alarm system's on and their fight or flight you know, that, like you say, they're not in a position to be able to go into hypnosis easily. It's not impossible, but we do have, for people that are very anxious, because obviously we work with anxiety a lot, people that are very anxious, we can do longer inductions. We've got so many different types of tools that enable us to really meet somebody where they're at, because, you know, it's not one size fits all.
And how does that work in the remote setting? So
really well.
Like, I mean, in terms of the actual setup. So is it like with us now, both are sitting in front of their computer, or do they have like earbuds?
Doesn't
and
matter.
Like AirPods, and they lie on the couch and they just hear the audio?
They all normally lie down.
Yeah,
so you would with AirPods or headphones or something like this? Or...
It doesn't matter.
Not necessarily, no, but you've got to have good internet connection. You've got to be relaxed. You've got to agree. You've got to do like a hypnotic contract. So somebody's got to agree to be hypnotized and agree to be hypnotized by us. You know, it's like, you know, somebody needs to be prepared in their... We do a conscious hypnosis before we do a subconscious hypnosis. So somebody's got to understand from a cognitive level what we're exploring today, why we're exploring it, and agree that they no longer want the behavior, that the behavior is causing them certain pains or harms or whatever. Basically, it's personalized, obviously, depending on what they've come with. But the conscious hypnosis is just as important as the, you know, as the subconscious work, because you've got to, they've got to be fully wanting to explore. People obviously have resistance with the unfamiliar and the unknown. It's part of the process, but that's why our sort of therapeutic kind of skills and obviously ability to have rapport with the person is so important, because that journey from the beginning, you know, supports that person getting to a place then when they can really benefit from the hypnosis, you know, really allow their mind to go to the places that it needs to go in order to.
And it's also important to mention that before we talked about we've talked about safety. Once they've signed up, we give them a grounding and safety audio to listen to every day.
Yeah.
And in your, so I have heard. So I'm a psychologist myself, but not like I'm not a therapist. But there are like hypnotherapists who would, let's say, in terms of smoking cessation, in the state of hypnosis, attempt to link the behavior, the smoking, to something negative, right? Like whenever the person would sort of, you know, attempt to smoke, I don't know, you know, it would sort of taste awful or something like this. Is that something you're also doing, that you are conditioning or linking the gambling behavior, the establishment, the online, to something negative? Or are you working on the subconscious reasons for the gambling, the trauma, their experience?
Exactly.
That's
that.
What you do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The latter. It's all about, it doesn't matter really if it's gambling, if it's, you know, it could be any addiction. We've all got, you know, like John said, we've all got little addictions. You know, how many of us sit there doom scrolling, you know, and suddenly realize, you know, it's like, but they affect us to lesser or more degrees, but it doesn't really matter what it is. It's just been, you know, that's just gambling in this instance has been the coping mechanism that they sort of stumbled across, you know, that they chose. It sometimes it's linked, again, even the gambling with learned behavior. So they would have seen a parent, for example, gambling or being asked to go and place bets for a parent or whatever, and then they've observed those kind of interactions, but not always the case. It's just something that maybe they stumbled across once, and then it produced a feeling inside them that was better than the feeling that was there already, and then bam, it snowballed. And not obviously gambling for everyone is an issue, the same like booze for everyone isn't an issue, or smoking for everyone isn't an issue. You know, some people can pick things up and put things down. So we're very much less, in fact, you know, we do obviously find out, you know, bits about the gambling. There's certain practical measures that you can put in place and things depending on what somebody feels like they need. But it's very much not focused on the gambling, interestingly. So I think people kind of feel like that's going to be what we're talking about a lot, but it's not, you know. It
could be any behavioral change you want to achieve, right? Could it also be like, I just want to optimize my life, you know, I just want to be more efficient, right?
Yeah.
I want to get up earlier, watch less TV, train more, play more, you know, my instrument, whatever. Could it, or are you really focusing on the clinical cases? Or could do you also accept clients who would just want to be coached to become better versions of themselves?
Well, it's like you say, it's all about better versions of yourself. And we work with a variety of people, but right now we're really focused on gambling and affected others. Like we're full time on this because we haven't actually spoken about it yet, but we were just awarded funding for a sort of an innovative project, really. So it's a 12-week program for affected others, and that's affected others specifically of gambling addiction. Obviously the gamblers, like John said, might have other addictions as well, but you just need to be an affected other of gambling addiction. But we're super excited about that, and that's basically a combination of that and seeing our gamblers consumes our available time for work.
But we were trained to we can deal with any modality, Michael. Mm-hmm. But that's what we chose to niche.
Your training is ongoing, right? It's continuous.
Yeah, always. Yeah. Always. Yeah. Yeah.
I've got some questions. So, Lorraine, you're in Nottingham.
I am.
Do you know my friend Al?
I don't, but carry on.
Maybe you should not see.
That's it. That was the whole question.
Do I know your friend Al?
Yeah.
Al what?
Al Needham.
No.
It's a shame. He's a nice dude. He's come up in this podcast before. Bizarrely. He's a podcast host.
Really?
And one of our guests quoted his podcast to us. And I'm like, did you just quote the Chart Music podcast? And he's like, yeah. He said, Timmy? He said, yes, I'm a pop crazed teen. And I'm like, holy shit. And I texted Al while we were recording, like, you'll never guess what's just happened.
Really?
And I just thought maybe Lorraine knows him as well. Cause she's, you know, Nottingham's not the biggest city.
Fairly big that you won't just know people just by mentioning the name type of thing.
Well, you know, I'm from Ludlow. If you said, oh, I know somebody from Ludlow, and I'll be like, who are they? And you'll be like, oh, you don't know them. I bet I probably do. And I probably will. Ludlow is a bit smaller than Nottingham, though.
It is.
Congratulations on your funding for the 12-week program. I want to come to this is kind of in three parts, I guess. The first part is congratulations on your funding. Is everything that you're doing, are these frameworks that you've built yourselves, or are these, I'm honestly not trying to be facile when I say this at all. I'm assuming that there isn't like a shop where you can go and you can go, I'm going to need a 12-week course here. let's have a bit of that and a bit of that and a bit of that. Claire said earlier that you can meet people wherever they're at. Now, obviously that means that there's a huge amount of, it means that presumably everything you're doing is bespoke, but there must also be an overarching structure that supports what you're doing, kind of thing. Is this all your own invention?
Yes.
Yes and no. So in terms of...
Did you say no, Claire?
Yeah.
Travel in paradise.
You carry on.
So in terms of, we're talking about a couple of different things. So where we talk about, obviously, our one-to-ones being very kind of like we meet people where they're at, et cetera, that's obviously the benefit of what you get from a one-to-one. But within that one-to-one sort of package, there are certain themes that come up, you know, that are trans transferable across people. Like they all want to stop gambling, you know, so generally that is the root cause of the deep dive hypnotherapy that we're looking for. Not always the case, because sometimes people already understand that it's anger, say, for example, that's been like a precursor to gambling. So they might want to start with the emotion. So it, for example, we might then go in with anger. Obviously, we know anger's like the top of the iceberg and there's lots underneath. And then generally things like, you know, all the tools for emotional regulation come up, you know, different ones. But again, we have an idea about, you know, some people often want to sort of rebuild their relationship with their partners sometimes, etc. So we've got certain tools that obviously we learnt in training that we then use. So that's the tools as such aren't bespoke us, but I guess how we piece it together based on what somebody needs is bespoke, you know. And then obviously when you come to a group program like we're running for these affected others, that isn't, it's not a replacement for say one-to-one therapy, you know. But the journey that we're taking them on is the journey that, you know, we would support somebody with in a one-to-one on generally. So, for example, you know, the bottom of our triangle, like chaos to calm, what we've had to do is basically take all the problems generally that we see affected others facing. That's from our one-to-one work. It's from personal experience. It's from the 2,300 affected other group that we have, you know, it's from literature. It's like all the problems. Then we looked at how can we condense that down into sort of like three overarching problems that we're wanting to tackle, like within this group program. And obviously you could have an extension of another group after this and another group after this, but we were like, well, what do we want to do for this one? And so we boiled it down really, and the three kind of overarching problems that we're working on are taking somebody from feeling complete and utter chaos, like the carpet's being ripped from under your feet, you're hypervigilant, you're living in survival, you know, you've got really strong emotions that you've never been shown how to process properly. Your mind's constantly like on. You're not switching off at all. It impacts your sleep. It impacts your presence. It impacts everything. So that's the first bit we need to tackle. While you're living in that state, you can't move on. So we look at safety. We look at presence. We look at processing emotions. We look at how the mind works. We look at how they can manage fear and what it means, like what meanings are they attaching to things. Because an affected other constantly in the beginning thinks the only way that they can regain peace again is by managing the gambler or anything to do with the gambling. They outsource all of their, you know, energy and attention and power to the gambler. So it's about bringing them back to them. So despite what the gambler's doing, they can still create that rest time, that little bit of stability, that little bit of the pausing, a bit of awareness and pausing, so that then they can start to choose rather than react. So that's the first part. So the second part of the triangle, so the next lot of 4 weeks, that's really about an overarching problem of like financial struggle, you know, the nature of gambling, that's the big impact. And then we then support them with financial resilience. And in order to do that, they need to look at their like self-trust again and any enabling behaviours. Any money as a trigger, and practical skills around money, and practical support that they can start to implement, and different services that can support with that as well. And then on the last kind of main overarching kind of issue, it boils down to is this real horrible feeling of powerlessness. And so from that, we move them from feeling like the solution is empowered. And that's about looking at their values, looking at boundaries, looking at their self-worth, looking at joy, looking at how they can reframe this experience that they're in and see that through sometimes our greatest challenges becomes our greatest growth and evolution. And so this is a really long-winded way to explain that there's that journey we're taking them on is something that we've created. So I guess what you would say is like that's our kind of our stamp, our creation on it. But obviously the tools that we're using within them are tools that we've used multiple times before, say in one-to-one work or I mean, all the tools we've used as well, we've used ourselves. So it's a combination of like our signature on tools we know that work.
Okay.
Well, in the one-to-one setting, the hypno setting, did you ever, I mean, is there a, every therapy has risks. Is there a risk that, you know, a trauma might be uncovered that's so severe, you know, the person suppressed it, whatever it might be, that they would, you know, completely spiral out? And given the remote setting, you can't really help the person. Did you ever face any of these, or what's the protocol if something like this might happen?
Yeah, well, we've got safeguarding protocols, and we also take things like GP and next of kin, and you know, so we've got other contacts. But I mean, it personally hasn't happened yet, you know, for me. But I mean, obviously, people have big emotional reactions and things, but because of the setup that we give in terms of supporting and managing them, and we also give them WhatsApp access to us as well, so they have within kind of work hours 5 days a week support with us. So we're constantly checking in. We've got that dialogue going the whole time with people should they need it. But you know, people do uncover, they do uncover things that, you know, and it can, that's, you know, part as well as when we speak to people in the first course, you know, we don't know what's going to come up, and they might not know what's going to come up. So that is part of our onboarding, you know, process with them. But we just support them, I guess, like any health professional would. And obviously there's crisis support in specific geographical areas that people can access, obviously their GP.
Also, personally, it's not happened to me. We've also got a PTSD protocol, and all our tools that we use helps if that should happen.
And what's the typical number of sessions that somebody requires? Or what's the outcome of success? So basically, are you, like in psychoanalysis, the goal is really to relieve somebody of all of their, you know, trauma, which can take 10 years, 20 years, whatever, or it's probably lifelong. In behavioral, cognitive behavioral therapy, it's about, okay, you know, working on one behavior, you want to change it, and once you manage your therapy, you know, ebbs out. What's your success criteria? I mean, what's your goal actually in the therapy?
Yeah, we
also tied into that just a little bit, sorry to jump in, what's the frequency of the sessions early on? Does the frequency stay the same, or is there more frequency early on to try and
plant that seed? So the goals are whatever the client wants the goal to be. So we do, we get some people that come in and they just want to remove the behavior, and then we get other people that once they've sort of being able to stop the gambling, they then want to go further and work on other things that are linked with, you know, for example, like the last client I worked with, I was doing a lot to do with heart rate. You know, he after we'd looked at the gambling, so in the beginning, to answer John as well, so we would do a session a week for minimum 6 weeks. But as I say, we have WhatsApp support in between, and those sessions vary. So, for example, the intake session can be anything from an hour to an hour and a half. And then we do like a power activation session, which is supporting them with all the nervous system regulation. And that can be sort of an hour to an hour and 15. Then a deep dive hypnotherapy is 2 hours. And then we do a coaching session / hypnotherapy / embodiment somatic, depending on what they need. And then it really depends on the person. So if the person, you know, in the intake has a lot of issues from their childhood, you know, we we leave space to do another deeper dive hypnotherapy session again on, say, week five. It's really personal, but like then, for example, as I say, the last client that I've just finished working with, we did another then lot of six sessions, and that was really looking at traits of the heart, because there was a struggle to kind of access, like, gratitude, compassion, a real sense, feeling of love, you know. So that was the focus of our next kind of six sessions. So it's really individual as
it's very individualized
wants to work with, and how, you know, how much they want to explore about their past. And then, for example, that client's now chosen to, you know, stop, doesn't want to do another six sessions. There's still stuff that, as a therapist, I could see, but equally somebody's got to catch up with where they're at, you know, where they're living now and how they're living. And then potentially some people then come back again and some people don't. So
it's on a case by case basis, John.
I see. I accidentally muted myself. Because I clear my throat and things like that. So there you go. There was something that you said earlier, and I'm not going to remember the right terminology because I'm a bit tired. But it's quite a while ago in the conversation. But we were talking about, I think it was after Lorraine, you gave the example of the lady who came on the call and then went to get the person that needed help. And it was something like how the affected others are included in the process, and they have things that they have to go and do. And the person at the heart of it has probably things that they have to go and do. And it got me thinking about that, right? Because, and you'll obviously know this yourself, but what you were describing struck me as a scenario where an enormous amount of trust is required in a relationship where, in almost every instance I can think of, trust is gone. And given that we're not talking about what Michael mentioned a few minutes ago about, you know, a therapy type or a structure that would be like 10, 20 years, how on earth do you cope with that lack of that broken trust on their side? Because you're really saying to them, you need to trust this dude to go and do what they're going to do, and you need to go and do what you're going to do and let them get on with it. How on earth do you, is that something that you can even broach in what you do? Is that just outside of what you do, and you just say, you either get on with it or you get out?
Well, so we work, when we've worked just with the gambler, the one we've not been involved in the affected others, and ironically people have said to us, well, you do couples coaching, is trust. And interestingly, I did a bit of a look at this, because I'm in various groups, and from a gambler it is, I don't trust myself, and from an affected other it's, I don't trust them. So it's building.
I don't
that.
Trust them either.
Yeah. But two different, yeah. And they lose trust in themselves as well. So they're second guessing what is the truth. So it's rebuilding that trust. So, for example, like Claire was describing on the 12-week program, we look at all of that and help them rebuild the trust. But trust comes from the gambler taking the action consistently.
I think it's also important to understand that, like, life is inherently uncertain, you know, the affected other particularly, they need to learn that they can trust themselves to cope despite the challenges in life, because that is the key bit, really. It's like, you know, trust with somebody else is always potentially fragile. You know, it relies on two people that have got different ideas. And like we say, next month things can change. But it's like, as an affected other, if you trust that you can stay in the present moment because you know that you've got the skills and the resources and you've developed that resilience, that whatever happens, you will bounce back and you will rise. That's the power. It's like the focus isn't necessarily on, initially it's got there's two individual pieces of work happening, you know, rather than bringing them together at that point. It's the kind of individual healing before you can do the kind of the joint healing around trust.
I think you touched on something interesting there, Lorraine, when you said about not trusting yourself. We had a conversation about faith on a previous episode of this podcast. And I something I was talking to my daughter about this weekend. I was saying to her, where does confidence come from? It comes from experience. So, you know, do that thing I'm asking you to do and you might get a bit more confidence about it, kind of thing. But losing it, especially as an adult, it's an extremely difficult thing to recapture. But losing trust in yourself, I mean, but it's two sides of the same coin, trust and faith. My words are failing me today. I'm sorry, guys. There's an aspect of faith which is almost not blind, but when you have it, it's an unquestioning thing. You have this belief, you have this anchor, and I'm a great believer in it. And thinking about in the context that we're talking about it in, it brings home to me in this conversation how sort of broken somebody might feel to have lost that. Because this is one of the little cornerstones of self, of identity. That thing of just believing it, just trusting yourself, believing in yourself, believing in your choices and your decisions. And the idea that somebody has lost that, I mean, it's brought home to me today how devastating events must have been to get them to that point. I mean,
absolutely.
There wasn't a question attached to that. I just thought I'd ramble on for a minute.
No, I'm glad you've had that reflection, John.
Well, you know, I always learn something when I'm talking to you, Lorraine.
Good.
Disappointed that you don't know Al, though.
I'll look Al Needham up. Is it Al Needham?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll look Al Needham up when I finish this.
He's sometimes introduced as, this is going to sound really bad, he's sometimes introduced when he does TV and stuff as Nottingham's Mr. Sex.
Oh, gosh.
But his podcast is amazing.
Where is this leading, John? Where is this leading?
All good places. His podcast is amazing. It's called Chart Music. And it's basically him and some generally journalists or funny people or whatever. And they watch old episodes of Top of the Pops.
Top of the Pops.
And talk about it on the podcast.
Wow.
It's genius. Proper genius. But guys, I'm going to have to bring this to a close here because this is called An Hour with Hour. And although episode lengths may vary, we do generally try and deliver value, don't we, Michael?
Absolutely. And I mean, in this episode, we at least helped you, it seems.
A little bit.
Yeah. Subconsciously, maybe.
I didn't even get into the binge eating, though. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I think these guys might be able to nail that for me.
Well, I saw on Marissa Pierce website, that's also a topic dedicated topic, you know, to how to stop your snacking.
I don't think it comes just under snacking. But let's talk offline. Claire, Lorraine, thank you very, very much for joining us. Much appreciated. Where can people find out about what you're doing?
I was absolutely waiting for you to say that, John. If not, I was going to interrupt. www.gamblingrecoverytherapy.com. And then there's a page there for affected others. And they can learn all about the 12-week funded program. There's 4 cohorts, which we're doing between now and next June.
Fabulous. Thank you very much. Best of luck with the program.
Thank you.
Thank you for your company.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. It was great.